So good afternoon. Let's see if I can do this. Okay. Then I think we ought to have a disclosure slide. That's my disclosure slide. That was quick enough, right? Okay. So Jim talked a lot about what we see in workplaces. So now I'm going to talk some about where we think all of this is coming from, some of the pressures. So the BLS data shows significant and steady decline in injury and illness rates. And for those here from BLS, yes, this is the total recordable non-fatal occupational injury and illness incident rate in private industry. Going from 8.9 cases per 100 full-time employees in 1992 to 3.6 cases this last year, 2009, that's a 59.5% decline in recordable injury rates. In the last decade, it's been a 48% decline. And Susan Baker from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health gave this quote, "It is extremely unlikely that injury rates would plummet like this." So folks may be familiar with this report from Congress. This is from Chairman George Miller that came out in June of 2008, looking at underreporting of workplace injuries and illnesses. And I recommend this to anyone who hasn't read it. Pages 14 to 29 detail every kind of thing that employers are doing to discourage the reporting of injuries and illnesses, the kinds of things that Jim just talked with us about. But in this report, they start with, why is accurate record keeping important? It's important for targeting of OSHA inspections, for setting OSHA priorities, for judging the effectiveness of OSHA programs, and determining the state of workplace health and safety in the country. So I want to do a little early history here of OSHA's use of employers' injury and illness data. In 1982, federal OSHA created the Voluntary Protection Program. That actually came from a California-based program called the Cooperative Self-Inspection Program. But OSHA's VPP, as it's called, recognizes workplaces that have implemented effective safety and health management systems, but also, and very importantly, those that maintain injury and illness rates below the national BLS average for their respective industries. If you get into the Voluntary Protection Program, you become exempt from OSHA-programmed inspections. Then, also in the Reagan years, were the inspection exemptions and records check inspections. These were all exemptions based on employers keeping injury and illness data that shows that they were below a national average. During that time, 75% of all manufacturing employers were exempted from routine OSHA inspections because their numbers showed that they were good. In 1983, over half of the actual inspections that were done in workplaces were paper reviews of employer records. No inspections were done because the first thing the OSHA investigator did, the COSHO did, was go in and look at the OSHA 300. It was at the OSHA 200 log at that point. But if the numbers showed that they were below the national average, then an inspection never happened. Now, the records inspections were eventually discredited and faded away. We had a number of situations, I believe, in meatpacking, where it was discovered that the employer kept a double set of books. But there was also film recovery systems, and I don't know how many people remember that. It was an operation outside of Chicago where they claimed silver from X-ray films, and you did that by dunking the films in big vats of cyanide. This employer hired all immigrant workers who didn't speak English. When the canisters of cyanide came in, they scraped the skull and crossbones off and called it El Chemical. And a Polish worker, Stefan Golab, one day was overcome by cyanide, pulled out on the lawn where he died. And the police, the cop on the scene, came and looked at the situation and went inside and saw the cyanide and decided that it was something up his alley. And he pursued a criminal prosecution The end result was that management officials did do jail time because of that. But what's important to know is that shortly before Stefan Golub died, an OSHA inspector was there and looked at film recovery systems records, and lo and behold, their injury rate was below the national average, so that inspector never went inside and never saw the scene, which became the scene of the crime. So there were early studies that identified problems with employer-kept injury and illness statistics, and this is from John Reuther and Robert Smith from 1988. They found consistent evidence that inspection targeting based on firm-reported injury rates led firms to underreport injuries. Their conclusion: any system relied on for risk information must draw on data where the incentives to understate risk are low or kept in check by countervailing procedures. This is 1988. So then comes 1993. We're in the Clinton administration, and we had OSHA's Maine 200 program. Just asking folks in the room, anybody remember the Maine 200? Anybody remember the Maine? Okay, and the 200 program? Okay. So this was part of Clinton administration's reinventing government. It involved 200 employers in Maine with the highest injury and illness. It was the highest workers' compensation rates. And employers were given the opportunity to improve their conditions, provide reports to OSHA about the number of hazards identified and fixed and their injury and illness rates in return for a reduced chance of an OSHA inspection. So these employers, the other choice they were given is to be immediately given a comprehensive wall-to-wall inspection. So the 200 employers chose door number two. The results, employers claim to have identified and abated a total of 134,434 hazards in nearly 4.5 years and reduced serious injuries by 70%. And now for the real story. Nobody ever looked at what it was that employers said that they did to address hazards. So picking up some piece of paper off of the floor could well have been an abated hazard in the numbers game. The other thing is that a friend of mine, Ned McCann from the Maine AFL-CIO, and I went up to Maine and interviewed unions in some of the Maine 200 companies. And some of the things that we found out were, as I think we would not be surprised with this, but employers did the first piece of finding out where most of the injuries were happening, looked at those departments, laid off or fired the workforce, brought in a temporary workforce that was not under their control. And so amazingly, the injury rate for that employer dropped tremendously, and what a success. The other issue with the Maine 200 program was the DeCoster Egg Farm. DeCoster participated in the Maine 200 program for 2 years. It supplied reports to OSHA saying everything was hunky-dory. In August of 1995, still in the Maine 200 program, a worker was killed at the DeCoster Egg Farm, and when OSHA went in, what they found were 37 cases of unguarded machines, 18 instances of electrical violations, 23 sanitation and other violations. People were living in squalor provided by the company housing. OSHA found an employee who had 3 fingers cut off by a machine that was used to scrape chicken manure, and that worker had to wait hours before getting the medical attention for his wounds. That was DeCoster Egg Farm in the OSHA 200 program. In the Maine 200 program. So what happened after that? In 1997, OSHA, still under the Clinton administration, decided to expand the Maine 200 program. Goes national, they called it the Cooperative Compliance Program. In this case, they took 12,250 employees with high injury illness rates and put them on a list and offered them the ability to be in this program, for which if they provided, said that they put together a good health and safety program and provided injury data to OSHA, they wouldn't be on OSHA's primary inspection list. In order to set this up, in 1996, OSHA started the data initiative, where they were first collected the site-specific injury and illness data from 80,000 employers. Again, this is coming off of employers' OSHA 300 logs, the logs that they keep of their injuries and illnesses. So 1997 was going to start the cooperative compliance program. In April of 1999, there was a court ruling. Actually, the Chamber of Commerce had brought a lawsuit against this, and the cooperative compliance program was ended before it really started. However, in April 1999, after that lawsuit, OSHA started its site-specific targeting inspection program. So it took those employers with high injury and illness rates and put them on a list to receive an OSHA inspection. And these site-specific targeting plans are based on the self-reported injury and illness information submitted by employers to OSHA's data initiative, and the site-specific targeting program continues to this day, and therein lies the rub. All right. Let's go now to May 2009, last year. There was a GAO report, Government Accountability Office report, on voluntary protection program. It was called OSHA's Voluntary Protection Program's Improved Oversight and Controls Would Better Ensure Program Quality. And one of the big findings, OSHA has not developed goals or measures to assess performance of the VPP, and the agency's efforts to evaluate the program's effectiveness have been inadequate. Now, we can just go back to the GAO report from 2004 on the VPP, where it said OSHA's voluntary compliance strategies show promising results but should be fully evaluated before they are expanded. That never happened. So I want to share with you Dr. Celeste Monforton, who many of you know, writes for the Pump Handle blog, and in August of 2009, she was responding to the GAO report about VPP and wrote in the blog, as far as measuring a site's program effectiveness, simple calculations of incident rates are probably not sufficient. So I want to share now with you some responses to Celeste's blog. What is the purpose of effective safety and health management? Is it not to send everyone home at the end of the day free from workplace-related injury and illness? Accordingly, I can think of no more accurate measure of a program's effectiveness than injury and illness rates. Next one. The bottom line is that VPP sites are an average of 50% below the TCIR for like facilities, that's total case incident rate, for like facilities in the same classification. Just how can the program's overall effectiveness be questioned in light of the statistical evidence? How indeed. All right, so here's some current information from OSHA's VPP. There are currently over 2,200 VPP sites. Between 2003 and July 2010, there have been, this is preliminary data, 52 fatalities at these incredibly fabulous programs where OSHA doesn't need to do programmed inspections anymore. Countless VPP site employers have implemented behavior-based safety programs, including those with policies and practices that discourage injury reporting. And the primary measure of effectiveness for a VPP site is still the total case incident rate and days away restricted and transfer rate, the DART rate. So we're still using those OSHA 300 log employer-kept statistics to measure all of this. In 2009, October, a year ago, the GAO came out with another report. This was called "The Workplace Safety and Health Enhancing OSHA's Records Audit Process Could Improve Accuracy of Worker Injury and Illness Data." And that report from a survey shared that more than two-thirds of injured workers feared employer discipline or losing their jobs if they reported their job injuries. Over half of occupational health practitioners said they were pressured by employers to downplay an injury to avoid it being an OSHA recordable, and a third of occupational health practitioners said they were pressured by employers to provide insufficient treatment to injured workers. So on September 30th, this is a very important date, 2009, OSHA unveiled its Injury and Illness Record-Keeping National Emphasis Program. This is right before that GAO report came out. This is OSHA's first comprehensive attempt to look at employer-kept injury and illness data and records, look at backup documents, do worker interviews. Not easy stuff, but very exciting to us. It is designed to identify and correct under-recorded and incorrectly recorded cases. Employers in 19 industries would be reviewing and receiving comprehensive records review interviews and all of that, and they chose places that had low injury rates in industries that had historically high hazard, high injury experience. So in between then and now, OSHA has cited the Goodman Manufacturing Company over 1.2 million for hiding job injuries. That was issued September 1st of this year, and there were 83 willful citations for failing to record and recording improperly. We also saw on October 5th, last month, OSHA fined AK Steel Corporation $53,000 for failing to record, and those were five willful and other, and I'll give a quote from our Assistant Secretary of Labor for OSHA, Dr. David Michaels. He said in the press release, AK Steel implemented policies where a portion of its manager's bonus money often involves taking disciplinary action against workers for reporting injuries. He went on to say, if accurate records are not compiled because workers believe they will be fired or disciplined for reporting an injury, or supervisors fear they will lose their bonuses if workers report injuries, real safety is not being achieved. Accurate workplace injury and illness records are vital tools for identifying hazards and protecting workers' health and safety. Now, what does AK Steel say about this? We find it not to be credible that someone would not report a serious injury out of fear of being disciplined. All right, then most recently, or very recently, on October 27th, another big fine here. This is Lowe's in Rockford, Illinois, and the fine was for $182,000 for willful and repeat violations of record keeping. So we have now, bringing us to just a couple weeks ago also, 2009 BLS data. And what we find out this year is that there's been yet another decline of our injury and illness statistics in the workplace, from 3.9 cases in 2008 to 3.6 cases. Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis made the following comment on that. While the reporting decline is encouraging, 3.3 million workplace injuries are 3.3 too many. Complete and accurate workplace injury records can serve as the basis for employer programs to investigate injuries. We are concerned about the widespread existence of programs that discourage workers from reporting injuries, and we will continue to issue citations and penalties to employers that intentionally under-report workplace injuries. So, over the last year, OSHA's National Emphasis Program on Record-Keeping conducted 187 inspections. OSHA found record-keeping violations in about half of the inspections, and on September 28th of this year, OSHA just revised its criteria for the inspections. They're going to focus now on larger companies and more manufacturing sites, and they're going to be looking at a rate that is just slightly below the cutoff that OSHA uses to put companies in the site-specific targeting to get an OSHA inspection. So I wanted to share with you now what some critics are saying. This is from a blog called Fair Warning on November 4th. Critics of OSHA's record-keeping national emphasis program argue that recent inspections demonstrate that injury underreporting is a relatively rare problem. Baruch Fellner, a prominent management lawyer who specializes in OSHA issues, called it a case of the agency frittering away resources looking for a conspiracy that does not exist. So, now this is bringing us to October 22nd, when we had a press release from OSHA saying that OSHA is yet again targeting high-hazard work sites for inspections. And this is again using the 80,000 employers and the injury and illness data from the OSHA 300 logs. And again, they're going to be going out and doing inspections of those with the highest injury rates. And once again, this is all based on employer-kept OSHA 300 logs. This is the kind of thing that is actually putting pressure on employers to do all the things that they're doing to workers to get them not to report. From OSHA's website, all about VPP. How has VPP improved worker safety and health? Statistical evidence for VPP's success is impressive. The average VPP worksite has a days away restricted or transferred case rate of 52% below the average for the industry. So again, using OSHA logs that employers keep to get these kinds of statistics is extremely, extremely troubling in light of the fact of how many employers out there now have policies, programs, and practices that are discouraging workers from reporting injuries and illnesses. It, in fact, has gotten to the point where many of us feel that the OSHA 300 log maybe is good for what's on there, looking at, okay, how was somebody hurt, and let's go back and find the hazard and fix it. But in terms of injury and illness statistics, it's useless. OSHA 300 log needs to be trashed until we can figure out how to make the statistics meaningful. It's fiction right now. So what do we say should happen? Right now in our workplaces and the steelworkers, we say, here's the things to measure. How many hazards have been identified? How many hazards have been eliminated? How many hazards have been reduced? And how long did it take between the time that the hazard was identified and it was addressed? And so we have signs like this up in our workplace. It's been 14 days since local whoever told management to fix whatever it is, and they still haven't addressed this problem. And then if that still is not fixed by the next day, it'll be 15 days. And that's what we're going to count, and that's what we're going to track until or unless we can get to a place where all workers are free to report what is happening with them. So on a positive note, on October 11th of this year, the Voluntary Protection Program Participants Association issued a press release. And in that press release, they said that the Voluntary Protection Program Participants Association supports OSHA's position on incentive programs. The association and its members disapprove of programs that discourage employees from reporting injuries and illnesses because they want to receive a reward. So that's a positive place, but yet still VPP companies who are applying today to get in, they're going to be looking at those rates. OSHA, when it's out inspecting right now, has a list based on the 300 log of employers who have, you know, whatever injury and illness rate the employer has said they have. And so what we say is, to make all of this real and meaningful, and back to the question we started with, is OSHA, you know, identifying effective safety and health programs in employers, or is it discouraging the reporting of injuries and illnesses? And we say right now, it's doing both. To make this real, OSHA must find a way to outlaw employer policies, practices, and programs that can discourage workers from reporting symptoms, injuries, illnesses, and hazards, and they must make penalties for violations truly meaningful. And if they can do that, that would be an important step towards social justice. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I don't have a slide of the Rocky Mountain National Park, but we can all imagine that. because our next speaker does not have a PowerPoint presentation. So, and he will be Bill Hoyle, who is the senior investigator for the Chemical Safety Board. Prior to his joining the CSB 12 years ago, he was a safety trainer and curriculum writer for the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, and was also an oil refinery operator for over 15 years. So, Bill.
Okay, well, I learned something new this afternoon. Never follow Nancy Lesson, but I will anyway. There's plenty of seats up front. If you want to come up, plenty of empty seats. Well, I'm going to start with old news and go to new news. I had the responsibility of leading the initial investigation team into BP Texas City 5 years ago. Explosion that killed 15 and injured 180. One of the things that CSB learned in that investigation is that this facility, the third largest refinery in the United States, had an OSHA recordable injury illness rate that was 8 times lower than the average for general industry and 6 times lower than the average for their sector. It was an award-winning safety facility up till the day that 15 died. So this information could have served as a wake-up call for the oil industry. But the problem is, it does not appear that the industry woke up, because there are serious incidents and the problem with the OSHA recordable rate has continued. Jim Frederick earlier talked about Tesoro in Anacortes, Washington, which on April of this year, 7 workers died in an explosion fire. Not only had they won the National Petrochemical Refiners Association Safety Award in earlier years, as cited by Jim, but the very month after that disaster, they were scheduled to be honored at the Safety Awards Banquet of the National Petrochemical Refiners Association for their outstanding safety performance. That was scheduled for the very next month after the disaster. But it goes further. The Upper Big Branch mine disaster, also in April of this year, 29 workers died. That facility had been honored and recognized by MSHA, the Mine Safety Health Administration, as a top safety performer based on the injury rate, an award-winning safety program. And now I'm working on the Deepwater Horizon investigation in the Gulf of Mexico. And it is ironic that on the day of the disaster that killed 11 workers and resulted in a 3-month long oil spill, that top BP executives were on the Transocean oil rig to celebrate the Transocean rig working 7 years without a lost time injury. A truly exceptional safety program being celebrated the day of the disaster. So, is this all coincidence, or is there a message here? I think there's a message here. And in fact, you know, the OSHA injury recordable rate for many workplaces, for I will say most workplaces, is not a very good measure of our overall safety performance. Certainly not in the oil and chemical industry. Well, So I was very glad to see when David Michaels joined OSHA, one of the first public events was some public meetings called, I think, something like OSHA Listens. And one of the questions David kept asking people, the witnesses in that proceeding, was, well, are there some better ways to measure workplace safety performance that we could use? And I wish there were better responses at that time. But I think the question is the right question. And I think we need to continue to look at that, and I'll pursue that in this presentation. Now, more recently, Jordan Barab from OSHA has been in his presentations to the industry, to the chemical and oil industry, has also publicly called for the industry to use broader measures of safety performance beyond the OSHA injury illness rate. And I'll return to that in a minute. Now I want to depart to something that I've been thinking about. I've been working on this issue for a long time, but in the last year, some new thoughts have come to mind. And I want to explore the connection between worker safety and environmental protection as it relates to this issue. And I think this is one of the lessons of the Deepwater Horizon. The Deepwater Horizon was an environmental disaster, perhaps one of the worst in our lifetime in the United States, one of the worst. But this was a workplace safety incident. It was a workplace safety incident. 11 workers died. Prevention of those worker injuries and deaths would have prevented the environmental devastation. And we need to think more about how do we connect these issues. And I think it has a relevance in this conversation about how do we measure safety. On Saturday, I spoke on a panel on the Deepwater Horizon incident, and one of the other speakers was from the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. And they had studied the environmental incident reports for all the oil refineries in the state of Louisiana, and there's quite a number of them. And one of their conclusions was that one refinery in particular had by far the most reports, and it was an ExxonMobil refinery. The speaker said it was the second largest in the United States, and said that they averaged an environmental incident report every other day or every third day, all year long. But I will offer to you, I haven't looked it up yet, but I'm confident that that facility has a very low OSHA recordable injury rate, like almost all refineries do. They have very low OSHA recordable injury and illness rates. So how can that be? Can a facility have an outstanding worker safety program and at the same time have a deficient environmental protection program? Can that be? Does that make sense? Are these things connected? Or is the problem how we're measuring performance? But I think there's some things that we can do. I think there's some things that OSHA can do. I think there's some things EPA can do. One thought would be, couldn't OSHA and EPA do joint inspections of the process industry where OSHA is doing a PSM inspection and OSHA is doing a risk management plan, a parallel regulation inspection? Couldn't those be done together with a common strategy? A thought. Couldn't OSHA in its VPP program also factor into that environmental data, environmental performance data, is one of the things that's looked at for both getting and staying in the program? Something to consider. And could OSHA also look, because this environmental reporting data is public information, couldn't OSHA look at that information when it's targeting for inspections oil and chemical facilities? Couldn't it be one of the criteria in addition to the injury rate? It's available data. Does it make sense? So I think there's some things that maybe can be done that don't take new regulations, but something to consider. You know, these incidents in the refineries, it's not just the environmental reports. The United Steelworkers Union has reported, they keep their own data on oil refinery safety. They report that there's on average a significant fire in one of the oil refineries in the United States every week. That's really quite a statement. Because if you think about it, what if commercial airlines were operated like oil refineries? A crash a week. The public would stop flying. So, you know, what are we measuring? You know, would you select, if you're picking an airline to fly, would you select it based on their OSHA recordable injury rate as the measure of airline safety performance? I don't think so. But yet that's the measure that we're using. I'll give another example that's closer to my home, the DC Metro system, which is the way I get to work every day. The subway, the metro system in DC, has had a terrible number of injuries and fatalities in recent years. In fact, one report I read said that 40-some percent of all fatalities in metro systems in the entire United States were in the DC metro system in recent years. It wasn't long ago that there was an incident where two trains collided and 9 members of the public were killed. It was just fortunate that the train happened to be going the opposite direction of the rush hour, so the train was relatively not that full. If it had been full, who knows what the death toll might have been. Well, you know, the NTSB has been investigating that, and one of the things that they've found, it's not so much that the metro system has a high injury rate, but it kills people a lot, and it has a lot of public both workers and the public, but they found a really deficient safety culture. In fact, a survey after these disasters, a survey was done of the workforce, and one of the key findings of the survey was that a big percentage, I think it was about a third of the workforce, reported that they did not report hazards or near misses because they're worried about the consequences of that report, or it wouldn't make any difference. So these are all part of learning. If we look more broadly about how we frame the problem of measuring safety, I think there's a lot of blueprints out there, information that helps us unravel it. Now, you know, the oil industry and chemical industry has not done nothing since 2005. They do have a new API, American Petroleum Institute has a new guideline on safety indicators. Some of the challenges with that are that use of those indicators is totally voluntary by any company or by any site. In other words, you can continue to be a member in good standing with the American Petroleum Institute. You don't have to implement any API guidelines. And there's no auditing of that, and there's no requirement to implement any of them. So it's totally voluntary. But the thing that's a problem in CSB investigations, what we continue to find is that when it comes to, while there are broader indicators, BP Texas City in 2005 had all kinds of indicators, voluminous ones, but they weren't used to drive performance. What do I mean by that? I mean that here we are 5 years after Texas City, but overwhelmingly the industry still uses the OSHA injury and illness recordable rate is the basis for awards, bonuses, evaluations, and not just for workers, not just for supervisors, but for managers and for corporate executives. Still using the same measures. So it's something for us to think about. You know, we've talked about underreporting. Well, if your bonuses and many of these facilities now, these bonuses, the formulas now equal up to 25% of your base pay, 30% of your base pay. I mean, it's not a free pizza. It's a big part of your pay. And so we got to think about that. And what does it mean when that's how managers and supervisors and engineers and workers are rewarded? What's the consequence of that for safety and environmental protection? Well, let me conclude. I'm going to go a little shorter and so we have more time for conversation. You know, one of the perhaps the key regulatory initiative of OSHA now is the new safety programs standard, safety management system standard that they're working on. I think this is, I agree that that is the key to prevention. That's where we need to focus for maximizing prevention. But I think it's also important, how do we measure? The measurement has to be aligned with the prevention framework. If it's the case that safety management systems are the key to prevention, isn't it the case that that which we need to measure is the performance of the safety systems and not what workers are doing or not doing or what's happening to workers, which is important, but it's not enough. We need to measure the performance of those systems. So I think this discussion about how do we measure safety and what are new ways to do that is very much aligned with this new vision that safety management systems, safety programs are the key to prevention. We need to align how we measure safety and how we think about it with that new initiative. I think they're a perfect fit. Thank you.
So what we hoped to do now is actually, it's going to be really hard without a flip chart, but we wanted to have a discussion with whoever was in this room about how to deal with some of this, if there are creative ways or different kinds of ways of dealing with this problem. We think that it's so important that injury and illness statistics be real and true. They're not right now. And what we had hoped was to get a good discussion, and we would then bring back ideas to Dr. David Michaels, the Assistant Secretary of Labor for OSHA. We're not going to have to carry it too far because he happens to be in the room here. And so what, you know, this is phenomenal that we could maybe have this discussion with our Assistant Secretary of Labor for OSHA and others in this room who may have been thinking about this and really get some dialogue going so that we can move forward with solving some really tough problems at a time when our chances of being able to solve them are better than they had been in years past. So with that, I'd like to open the floor, and we'll go here and then around there.
First,
and somebody take
much.
Notes.
Very excellent presentations, you're right on point. You made no mention at all, however, of the census of fatal occupational injuries. And part of the reason I raised that is that I deal with agriculture, okay? In agriculture, as you probably know, 90% of U.S. farms are exempt, not only from reporting, but from even participating in the BLS survey. And that represents 50% of all the workers, of 1.2 million workers, totally out of the count. So we don't rely on the occupational injury and illness reports from BLS. It's not at all helpful. On the other hand, when we look at the Census of Fatal Occupational Injury, there we get data that is very helpful to us. And as it shows that in agriculture, forestry, and fishing, one of the 11 industry segments, it has the highest rate, about 30 per year, about 8 times the average for all other industries. Moreover, no improvement since 1992 when data first started getting collected. So how do we respond to that? Well, we're suing Cal OSHA over the heat illness cases. And we got a lot of good help from Dr. Michael's office, actually, in that, in finding that Cal OSHA was out of compliance. That's good news for us, because that could be brought into the court case. Moreover, I think it's possible to do things that I not only used the CFOI, but I was really interested in your work. I actually worked as a steelworker as a kid. Continental Camp W number 5, south of side of Chicago. But anyway, great union, love it. But at any rate, the main point of that is that by going in not just to the union leadership, which are valuable and important players, but doing cross-sectional survey research among workers and finding out what workers actually have to say. And what we do there is we learn, at least in agriculture, where we can't rely on any reporting data, that we get very useful information, very valuable information. And that can be promulgated and lead to other conclusions. So with that, it's just basically, do you use the CFOI data? Is that helpful? And number two, what about survey research among workers?
I'll quickly just say we find the fatality data much more credible than the injury and illness data. And the reason that it wasn't presented here is that it hasn't been nearly the problem that the injury and illness data is. It is a problem in terms of occupational disease. You know, it's acute traumatic fatality, and so there's still a whole bunch that goes missing. But I think for that, and if you look at statistics nationally, the fatality rate has stayed about the same. This last year it's dropped some, you know, and some people suggest it's the economy and all that stuff. But if you look at the fatality rate and look at the injury and illness rate, they're very different, and that tells a story.
Before you go on the survey of the workers?
Stand up. Who are you?
Tom Quist and I work with the Steel Workers Union, and we just completed a cross-sectional survey that does not get at injury and illness rates because we didn't have the capacity to really measure those in an authentic way, but do have information about the conditions that workers are experiencing in terms of physical conditions, types of machinery that we know cause injuries, and in terms of work organization issues, which complicate a lot of physical hazards.
So Jim talked about some of the issues that were raised in that very study. Garrett, you had.
So my name's Garrett Brown. I'm a compliance officer for Cal OSHA, and I've actually done almost all of the log 300 inspections in California, Northern California anyhow, and I've issued willfuls as a result. But it's very, very, very hard. These are really hard, labor-intensive. We have a six-month window to issue citations, and it takes you 5.5 months to get it together to do it. And that's even when you have a union and when you have workers helping participate. One of the spookiest things from this presentation is that 90% of the steelworkers' locations have problems with this. What's happening in non-union locations when we have 93% of private sector workers in the United States without a union? So this is just a tremendous problem, and very hard to do these inspections. I have a couple of things I'd like to say, one of which is that one of the reasons why the refineries have a low injury and illness rate is because a big chunk of the workforce are contractors. And the contractors, if they have injuries, go on the contractors, not on the refineries. So we have to figure out a way to have, because the log 300s are for employers, not for work sites. So we have to figure out a way how we're going to measure on work sites, including all the subs in construction, for example, or all the contractors on the site. The other thing is, just as you mentioned, there's the log 300s exempt all kinds of people, small employers, public employees. I mean, the fact of the matter is the log 300 captures a very, not small, but a very inadequate amount, concentration of people who work for a living in the United States. And the last thing I want to say is I've been thinking a lot because I spent 6 months going through these records trying to figure out how the hell I can get out of doing this. What other measures might we have? And I think some of the ones you mentioned about, you think about what is it you want, how do you measure safety programs, right? You have inspections, you have accident investigations, you have employee training. So those are the things that you want to try and figure out, how can we measure those? But there are problems. For example, if a hazard is picking a piece of paper off the floor, that counts as one hazard, then there's a lot of gaming that are going to go on with
right.
that. But I think that's the right way to go. The other thing is on training. You didn't mention training. You didn't mention accident investigations. We have lots of trouble in California because there's lots of training requirements. But a lot of the training requirements done at 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning. Everybody goes into a dark room. They
exactly.
put on a video for 20 minutes. Everybody sleeps. And they sign out on a sheet on the way out. Now, the only way we can figure out that's a BS training is somebody who was in that dark room sleeping is willing to own up to that fact. How likely is that? So even just training records are a little
right.
problematic because there's ways to cook those as well. But I think it's great that we should initiate a discussion about how can we have measures that, you know, safety system measures, inspections, accident investigations, and training, and make those real criteria, not things that can be gamed, or at least try and reduce the amount of gaming that can happen.
Let me add one thing to the issue of training, because something that we see a lot is employers who use those, and, you know, and there's a lot of online training that you're supposed to do, you know, whatever it is, but once you do it and you sign on the dotted line, that comes back to haunt you if you report an injury. They say, you were trained, you should have properly evaluated the situation. You didn't, you're getting automatic discipline for failure to properly evaluate the job because we have this record that says that you were trained. And so that now is being used against workers, and so it is definitely a problem. We'll go over to this side.
Yeah, Peter. My name is Peter Dooley. I'm a health and safety consultant. I worked for the United Auto Workers previously, and one piece of the solution to the to this issue, specifically around the hazards, is the close call systems or near miss systems that are explicitly free from any kind of disciplinary action. And I know many unions have negotiated these kind of programs where workers are guaranteed that if they identify a hazard and bring it to management, that there should be no disciplinary action connected with that. That could also be extended to injuries and illnesses, of course, and that could be part of a health and safety program standard, IP2. And so that's one thing I think we really need to be focusing in on is the experience with those programs. NASA has used that kind of program for decades, been very, very successful. It's used for production as well as safety, so it's something that I think need to really be paying attention to.
Great.
My name is Wayne Horn, and I'm from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And this has been a very interesting presentation. I want to perhaps before say a few things. Thank the steelworkers for the continued work. I enjoy working with Nancy Hutchins up in Ontario and hearing about Hard Rock Miners. This may be helpful. First, I guess I need to say I'm really kind of shocked. I was coming to this conference from Canada because I thought we're going to see some leading edge stuff. And I'll tell you, I feel a little better about my systems. I need to say and maybe give you some background. I was a legislator. I ran on one issue that I thought was very important to my community, and I ran on the fact that people were not being compensated properly for injuries. Not only were they not being compensated properly, employers weren't taking safety protocols properly. Much to my chagrin, I was a farm kid and I got elected. I couldn't believe it's just like two issues. But people are very, very, very prone to this. And I guess since that time I've learned a lot. Since that time I got to work with Nancy and we're lobbying for change. One of the things about vulnerable workers we're seeing is we started a pilot project and we actually got five employers, large employers, to comply. And we did a total audit of reportable injuries, non-reported injuries. What was really interesting, we started looking at indirect costs of injuries. So we started looking that we have to get out of the mentality of pretending as workers were widgets, or widgets, I should say, and replaceable. We have started looking at what those costs of replacing that labor was, where there was healthcare plans, what that cost was to the employer. So all those indirect costs. And sometimes when we start looking at lost time injuries, we really get into, we get pigeonholed, right? Because we're always just looking for that claim and we're not looking at all the hazards and costs. But what's been really, really exciting about this pilot is that employers are welcoming it and we're actually reducing injury rates because we're promoting higher wages controls. And by reducing injuries, we're not having to retrain workers every 4 years. The only thing that I'm very interested in, we did some surveys in Ontario, and I'm not kind of hearing, and I respect steel workers are starting to get into public sectors or universities, but we found that even in our heavy industries, we were finding that workers were just as susceptible in places like hospitals and long-term care facilities. In fact, we were finding that those employers' injury rates were probably double than what we expected to see in manufacturing or the auto sector or anything like that. So I guess if I could give you a message or maybe a strategy that's worked really well for us, was the first thing, we really went after those indirect costs. We knew what the compensation costs were been some doors open. So we are getting a report. The government of Ontario has also re-examined this issue, and on November 17th, they're saying that there will be new legislation coming down to protect workers who are vulnerable, and especially who are contributing to employment injuries. So those are some interesting things, but good job and good presentation.
I'll just do two quick responses. One has to do with the whole issue of public sector and service sector, and a lot of the programs that we first started seeing 20 and 30 years ago, prize programs to get people not to report injuries or discipline or post-injury drug testing, they were not seen at all in the public sector or the service sector, and they are now. They're being brought in. The other is that in the United States, we've also seen a real cost shifting, because when employers calculate costs, if something is workers' compensation, they pay 100% of it. If it is not work-related, then it goes on our health insurance, and employers are attempting to get workers to pay more and more of health insurance costs. And so there is a cost shifting that does reduce employers' costs. The society's costs aren't reduced, and workers' costs aren't reduced, but employers. So that's a little sticky wicket. Okay. Beth. Two hands back there, and then I'll get over there. So, what, either one. So thank you. And I think, I mean, one of the things that, you know, in a unionized situation, we have some bargaining rights when an employer wants to bring in various kinds of things. So one of the things that we do try to put on the table is, you know, sure, prizes are great, and here's what we want them for. Anyone who comes up with a, you know, identifies a hazard, anyone who comes up with a way to eliminate or reduce a hazard. But the other thing that I'll quickly say is we also do see that there is right now a section of OSHA's record-keeping rule that reminds employers that it is illegal to discriminate against workers for exercising their rights under the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and one of those rights is the right to report an injury. And so we have had some success in getting rid of programs, one where this big multinational employer was doing a prize program. Everybody who's in the facility, their name was in a hat, and periodically there'd be a drawing from the hat, and that person would go home with a big screen TV. But if you had an OSHA recordable injury, your name was taken out of the hat and you weren't allowed to participate. And it was Iowa OSHA that actually called this company and said they had to cease and desist. And we've done that likewise with some of the discipline programs. In one paper manufacturing facility, we had 17 workers who got a letter from the employer in their file saying, you've had too many injuries. The next injury, you're liable for discipline up to and including termination. Again, OSHA, when we got in touch with them and some folks wrote out complaints, they did call the company and say you have to cease and desist. So I think that there are some kinds of things that have been very helpful, and some wonderful folks in OSHA in the regions that have been tremendous allies. Glenn. Right, we're going to, we'll go here and then we'll go to Dr. Michaels.
So we mentioned the fatality data and some work related injury, but how about like some chronic things like muscular disorders? How are we going to keep that into this record? And it's kind of complicated because you may have no idea if you should blame your current company or your previous company. It's kind of a tricky issue. And also the other, maybe kind of straightforward question is, could we just make all these record systems at that time? And should we do that?
Make the record.
Because I just haven't talked to one of the researchers from BLS. They do not have too many people to figure out all the and perform something like that. So we kind of go electronic with a better way.
So I would just say, at this point, with the logs that we're familiar with that don't really tell the story, whether they're electronic or not, they're not going to have the information that, or the full information that we need. But certainly, it's something to think about. And as for the musculoskeletal disorders, we're still looking for the column to come back on the OSHA log. Right, with that, I'll go to.
Yeah. I want to thank you first. Nancy has been holding on this issue for 20 years, and it's really finally seen come to fruition. Well, even though she's taken on a number of years ago, it's very powerful. It has gotten worse, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
And so it's good that we're all sort of focusing on it. Because we do see this everywhere, and I don't know if the numbers that Jim presented are accurate, but they're obviously, they show that we have a huge problem. So, for residents, I understand your concern about the SST program, which targets inspection. The problem we have is that actually it's the most effective targeting program we have. Compared to all the other reasons we do inspections, worker complaints, national emergency program, when we go to sites and we identify through the SST program, we find the largest number of hazards. So we can't just trash that program until we figure out a better way to target, which I'll return to in a second. Incentive programs are really very insidious, but they don't have to be, and that's what Jenny was saying. When we say at the beginning of this discussion about today, when I start raising this issue with employers and with workers, I say incentive programs, are problematic. You really get a glance there. This intuitively makes sense. You think there's incentive programs are limited, and it really is important to make that transition. Say you can incentivize some things, not others. Certainly, you don't want to incentivize not reporting an injury, but involvement in training programs, hazard identification, are great to incentivize. And I've learned to always say that, because if you don't say that, participate in lunch the following week. They won't say they care about their limbs, but they care about their children. But injuries occur for lots of reasons, and giving them the opportunity to participate in a draft 2 weeks later is not really the impact on their behavior that day. And so it's not effective in, just from that point of view, also it's not effective in reducing injury rates. But how do we take the issue on, and that, you know, what are the alternatives? And what we really need is more empirical work in this area. I mean, we see that there's a problem. And, but you know, if you're an advocate of trying to make policy change, you have to tell the terrible stories. You know, we have those terrible stories for the elephant. But you have to show the, you know, how large is the problem and how can we identify it? I mean, Bill raised a great example of, you know, could we look, for example, at the environmental records of EPD companies? That's an easy study to do. And, you know, maybe they're better than everybody else, which tells one thing, and maybe they're equal to tell somebody else. And the group at University of Illinois Chicago, Linda Forrest, are doing studies looking at trauma reports outside of OSHA and outside of workers' compensation. And they've seen that even though injury rates are going down according to BLS, work-related trauma reports in so we know obviously there is a problem, but having, you know, strong data done by people with, you know, academic credentials is very important to us. And so it's sort of my plea in some ways, what I'd like to ask people to try and give us concrete, how do we look at these questions? How do we figure out what's going on? There's a study done by the group at Michigan State, Ken Rosenberg, that he's done with it. The answer to ask these questions, a number of variables studies on workers' compensation, on OSHA reporting, you know, if you look at BLS estimates for traumatic injuries in Michigan from 2007, I think, okay, and BLS, so it's just estimate, I mean, it's not an actual report number, but they tell you numbers, real numbers. But the estimate was in Michigan that year there were 170 traumatic amputations from workplace events, so like a BLS estimate. So, well, you know, how many really approach it? Contact the workers' compensation system, you contact the emergency rooms and hospitals around the state. You know how many they discover from the identified? Almost 800. So 70-something percent of those didn't get to OSHA into the BLS system, because BLS is based on the OSHA records. Now that doesn't mean they all should have been, because they could have been self-employed, they could have been on farms, and some were, no doubt. But clearly, we're missing a tremendous amount of information. So taking on those issues and, you know, really doing some strong studies would be very helpful to all of us, I think, in identifying how bad the problem is, where it exists, and how we can begin to address it. Right now, we don't have a lot of better solutions. We need to keep essentially looking at this problem and say, and pulling it apart as we develop those better indicators. So I'm hoping that out of this come some academics and more of your students and master's students who are looking for projects to take some of these issues up. So I think there's lots of data. We spend lots of time doing epidemiology, good epidemiologists. But I sometimes call it, you know, the boot care school of epidemiology. You know, looking at another aspect of the same risk factor that we looked at dozens of times. There's no one really looking at these issues.
So let me, I just want to respond to one thing. The SST that has gone on now since 96, that's the site-specific targeting, I think that we do appreciate OSHA being out there and doing that, but it's that same thing that is putting pressure on all of these, you know, workers, because their employers are responding to it. And I just wanted to go back to this, you know, study that was done around the records check inspections that says, you know, either you have to draw on data where the incentives to understate risk are low, or keep it in check by countervailing procedures. And that, I think, is what we're looking at this point, is the full force of the government to come down on employers who are doing the kinds of things that are happening every day. And so hopefully we'll get to that point.
Struck by the fact that in 1934, for the National Convention of the United Mine Workers, the keynote address speaker described a situation in which he said, everybody knows that 30% the miners will contract and die from miners' ashes. In 1968, the first study of the U.S. Public Health Service of the incident, or the incidence of coal workers' pneumoconiosis, did conclude that indeed 30% of the miners were dying from coal workers' pneumoconiosis or true black lung. When you looked at, or when I reviewed the records from Ohio, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, basically Kentucky, basically all of the mining, major mining states for coal mining, there had never been a case of coal workers' pneumoconiosis signed out as the cause of death because of the impact of the industry on the medical profession. So one of the things that then became fascinating, of course, was that in 68 and 69, there were tremendous struggles that led to the establishment of the Coal Mine Health and Safety Act. And then with that came reasonable reporting. And I think the lesson there is that workers who are organized have the capability of bringing information forward. They know what's going on. And I think whatever else we do with our statistical empiric studies, we need to find ways of just communicating and talking with workers and finding out what they perceive their experience to be, because it will often be exactly what the reality is.
Thanks. Steve.
I'm Steve Mitchell from UAW 974, and our experience has been workers are getting disciplined, discharged for reporting injuries, reporting hazards, and until we get 1904-36 away from being investigated under 11C and have people coming to do investigations related to all these bogus excuses that are given, the employers are not stupid enough to say that I'm disciplining you for reporting an injury. It's because you looked up something 2 years ago on a web-based training. And
there
on
you
page
go.
36, it mm-hmm. says this and you violate.
That's right.
Now, that's why people are being discharged. That's why they're being disciplined. And you know, we're getting that training, that well-intentioned training, shoved right down our throat. And you know, the dual motive argument, the whole game. I filed about 2011 C's charges for these members, and I've gotten nowhere. It's just really difficult. And so, all your representatives and the line still got a chance to pass the minor inspection and pick up the.
So for folks who aren't familiar, 11C is the section of the Occupational Safety and Health Act that says that it's illegal for employers to discriminate against you for exercising your rights under the law. I had one of our employers always tried to find a work rule violation if somebody reported an injury. And when they weren't able to always do that, they created Rule 24. And Rule 24 in this company was you must work carefully. So after that, anyone who reported an injury at least violated Rule 24, for which there was then discipline. Okay, other Maggie and then, yep.
Thank you.
Well, I know we're past 4 o'clock, so I don't know how the panel feels. We could take last two folks, and I'm going to start with you in the back. Yes, Jeff.
Jeff, I'm an occupational safety and health specialist for Civil Service Employees Association of New York State. Nancy's description of what happened with that cyanide fatality in the film recovery, that the compliance officer came to the site previously, went in, saw the injury rate, saw it was low, and didn't do a further investigation is really disturbing.
That was Reagan's rule. For OSHA under that time, it was a records check inspection, and that compliance officer was not allowed in the area. The only way under OSHA during that administration was if that injury rate had, if the recordable rate was, whatever, compared to the national average.
Has that changed?
Yes.
Because I'll only say that, what happens when a compliance officer comes in on a program inspection, if they don't look at all the programs, then things are missed. We had two fatalities in a place in New York State for permanent compliance space. And the employer did not do what they were supposed to do under the standard. And the compliance officer that came in, it's not OSHA. We're covered the public sector. We're covered under New York State Department of Labor. The compliance officer said he had been there 2 years prior, and it was a program of inspection, but he didn't look at their permanent compliance base program. And he made a comment in the opening conference that he felt bad that he didn't further investigate, because maybe those fatalities would not have happened. But the other thing I wanted to ask is, you mentioned fines that were levied against employers, and I know when I work for private sector, there's this bargaining that goes on.
Yes, it still
does. So were those the final fines, or were those fines before?
Those are proposed fines. It's all within the last couple months. Employers can challenge that. There has been a history of reducing, penalties have to be made significant or employers will keep doing this.
I just wanted to say, there are some stickers up here. One says, fix the hazards, don't blame the worker, and the other one is about eliminating hazards with a do not for behavioral safety, don't blame workers. So please help yourself. And thank you for coming.